What kind of uprising was the Dutch Revolt, also known as the 80 Years' War, and sometimes the Dutch War of Independence? In answering this question, we come up against many prevailing legends. Was it an uprising of Protestants against the tyranny of Philip II's Catholic Empire? Was it an uprising in the name of political freedom, throwing off the shackles of a foreign monarchy to establish an independent, republican Dutch nation-state? Or was this revolt a true revolution, a total transformation of the state of the Northern Low Countries? First, this conflict is the companion to the French Wars of Religion. One cannot understand one without the other. To focus solely on the Dutch is short-sighted, for this uprising is but one aspect of the twin behemoth struggles of the 16th century, that between the Catholics and Protestants, and those for and against Habsburg hegemony in Europe. What was the Netherlands to the Habsburgs? The home of the Spanish branch of the Habsburgs, the House of Burgundy, the base of the illustrious Order of the Golden Fleece. The country is one of the richest and most cultured in Europe, yet consisting of many distinct regions and cities which resented any attempt at centralisation. With the Reformation spreading throughout Europe, the Netherlands remained until the 1550s a Catholic bastion in a Protestant sea, a bastion that the Habsburgs wished to use as a base of operations against their Protestant and even Catholic rivals. Charles V had relocated his capital from Ghent to Toledo, and Philip would move again to Madrid. What was once a native dynasty had become a foreign Spanish one, and the subjects of the Netherlands resented what they now saw as an occupation by a foreign army. A league of prominent aristocrats saw this as an opportunity to stoke feelings of resentment, partially born of the Dutch contributions to Spain's wars, partially based on exaggerated fears of an expansion of the Spanish Inquisition to undermine the rule of King Philip II. At first, the aim was to rule the Netherlands in the king's stead, and to that end, these confederates, led by William, Prince of Orange, fomented a religious Calvinist revolution to dislodge the king's Catholic advisers. What followed was a series of escalating religious and political crises that pitted the Catholic Philip II against pseudo-Catholic and then openly Calvinist rebels at the increasing cost of the territorial and religious unity of the Netherlands and the idea of monarchy itself. In 1477, Charles the Bold, Duke of Burgundy, on the cusp of uniting his possessions into a single contiguous territory, and perhaps even a kingdom of Burgundy between the rivers Rhine, Rhone and Somme, was killed and mutilated before the walls of Nancy. His daughter Mary, now the Duchess of Burgundy, conceded a great charter to the States General of the Low Countries, the rump of her domain, after the confiscations of Burgundian territory in France by Louis XI. This charter upheld the regional character of the Netherlands, a collection of separate domains held together in a dynastic union under the House of Burgundy. Moreover, the States General compelled Mary to abolish the Parlement à Mechelen, a contrivance of her father Charles, seen by the Estates as a vehicle for the centralisation of royal law at the expense of lowland particularism. For ease of reference, while today the Netherlands is a distinct nation from the other Low Countries of Belgium, Luxembourg, the French provinces, or rather Departement of Artois, Flanders and Hainaut, the etymology of the word Netherlands is indeed the Low Countries, and contemporaries of this period use the name the Netherlands alongside the formal legal title of the Circle of Burgundy to refer to the entire region and not just the northern half centering on Holland. So I'll be employing the term Netherlands to refer to the entire lowlands region and parts of northern France ruled by the House of Burgundy, which again, for ease of reference, refers to the Burgundian and later Spanish branch of the House of Habsburg after the death of Mary of Burgundy in 1482. Mary's grandson, Charles of Ghent, later known as Emperor Charles V, who reached his majority in 1515, would complete the conquest of the Netherlands, in addition to his grand inheritance of Spain, southern Italy and the Holy Roman Empire. In the north, the Frisian Confederation, the so-called Frisian Freedom, had ended thanks to multiple aristocratic invasions, beginning with that of Albert of Saxony. The region was then sold to Charles of Ghent, who suppressed a rebellion led by Piers Gerlofs Donia. Piers's rebellion had been supported by Charles Egmont, Duke of Gueldres, the last major obstacle to unification. After conquering the bishopric of Utrecht, the now Emperor Charles forced Egmont to will his lands to him. The culturally Netherlandish Prince-Bishopric of Liège and the duchies of Cluses and Jülich would remain independent until the French Revolution. After the Emperor's triumph in the Schmalkaldic War against the Lutheran Protestant princes in Germany, he amalgamated the Netherlands into a single inheritable domain for the first time, the 17 provinces, or the Lordship of the Netherlands, which were passed to his son Philip II, along with Spain, a large portion of Italy, and the Spanish Empire in the New World. While Charles V had declared the Netherlands indivisible, the provinces still retained their own customs and institutions, albeit the power of the governors emanating from Brussels was consolidating under the Council of State, established at the start of the governorship of Charles's sister Mary of Hungary. The aforementioned Schmalkaldic War was an ill portent for the Netherlandish, heralding an escalation of hostilities not only against the French and the Turkic Ottomans, but against the Germans. Strategically, the Netherlands had become the Habsburg power base in the north, paramount to their aim of defending the Catholic faith in Europe. Furthermore, Charles V wished to integrate his domains economically and militarily with the nascent Habsburg monarchy to the east under his brother Ferdinand. All of this meant fewer trading partners with the mercantile Dutch, in addition to higher taxes. Philip II, now King of Spain and Lord of the Netherlands, was genuinely puzzled about his new inheritance. When he left the Netherlands for Spain in 1559, he declared that the country he was leaving was populous, rich, happy in its commerce, reputation and strength, religion flourished in sumptuous temples, that the court was splendid and popular, and that there was progress in the sciences, arts, and there was an abundance of faith, laws and privileges. Indeed, this was the legacy of the Burgundian Golden Age, inaugurated under his forebear Philip the Good. The vast majority of the people were Catholic and loyal to that faith. There was little anti-Catholic agitation, except among the Jews and Marinos in Antwerp and the other commercial centres. The term Marino had come to refer to crypto-Jews in Spain after the Alhambra decrees prohibited Judaism and expelled those who did not convert. Such Protestantism, mainly Calvinism, as it existed, was found in Antwerp, Brabant and places along the French border, where Huguenot influence had begun to assert itself. So deep and general was the reverence men felt for the Catholic faith that for several years, those who later became leaders of the Protestant faction did not dare show their hand and reveal their ultimate purposes for fear of antagonizing the people. Counter to his historical reputation, Philip had been more lenient in the Netherlands than his father had been. The religious dogmatism of Philip and his attempt at expanding the Spanish Inquisition in particular is held up as a principal factor for the Dutch revolt. However, it was Charles V and not Philip who introduced an Inquisition in the Netherlands. For, contrary to Protestant legend, the Spanish Inquisition was never introduced into the country at any time. In 1522, the Emperor Charles had appointed van der Hulst, a councillor of Brabant, to form a committee of inquisition at Antwerp, following the appearance there of the first Lutheran agitators. Pope Adrian VI, a native of the Netherlands, confirmed this. Pope Clement VII removed Hulst on the grounds that he was a layman, and therefore not competent, and ordered that three inquisitors be appointed in his stead. In 1527, there was a trial of 60 or more heretics, some of whom were condemned, others admitted to penance. When dealing with another myth of the revolt, that of a popular aspiration for democracy, or self-determination in the modern sense, we need to understand the sentiments towards monarchy in that period. The Dutch burgher, or town dweller, would have been astonished and even horrified if anyone had hinted to him that the deposition of an anointed king and sovereign lord would have been a positive development, that a king had no right to legislate, to appoint and dismiss councillors as he chose, and to raise the expenses of his government. To say that the Netherlands groaned under the despotism of Philip is to say that the subjects of Philip equated the rights and prerogatives of monarchy with despotism, for Philip II's manner of reign was well within the framework established by the Burgundian Habsburg rulers who had come to be generally accepted in the Netherlands. Nevertheless, the Spanish were disliked as foreigners. Philip, unlike his father, a native of Ghent in Flanders, was brought up in Spain and spoke neither Dutch, the language of the merchant class, the burgerliche, or French, the language of the aristocracy, and therefore was partly disliked because of his Spanish upbringing, but also his Spanish reserve and tastes, and partly again because of a deliberate propaganda campaign that had been working against him ever since it became known that he would be a committed Catholic. This was offset by the strong hold of feudal tradition in the minds and hearts of the people. The king was the visible embodiment of God's authority in the temporal order, as the pope was in the spiritual. To most men, the idea of raising a hand against his person or his rights was abhorrent. It made no essential difference that the monarch was not a native of a country. Respect for his inherited rights, or what men accepted as his lawfully inherited rights, was still stronger than any nationalistic feeling. In this sense, the Netherlanders accepted Philip more heartily than most Englishmen accepted the electors of Hanover as their sovereigns in the 18th century. Not until 1563 was there any hint of republican sentiment, and then it came from a small interested faction. That faction consisted of a small group of aristocrats, most of them with international connections to the Huguenots in France and the Lutherans in Germany. The letters Philip received from his agents in the Netherlands are full of references to this league or confederation, which carried on its deliberations under cover of banquets and other social activities at the houses of various members. A gentle reminder of the Dutch roots of the word Huguenot as Huisgenoten, or housemate, compared to the German root of Eigenossen, O fellows, or confederates. It is no coincidence that the Netherlandish movement coalesced during the years 1559 to 1562, when the Huguenots became openly aggressive in France with the Amboise conspiracy, an attempt to capture the young King Francis, and the first instances of iconoclasm also occurring in France. The principal members of the League were William, Prince of Orange. William the Taciturn, or Silent, was born to the German House of Nassau while inheriting Orange, a tiny principality near the Avignon enclave on the Rhone. Lamoral, Count of Egmont, and a relative of Charles, Duke of Gueldres, Philip de Montmorency, Count Horn, and his brother, Baron de Montigny. All these men were Catholics, or ostensibly Catholics. None of them disputed the right of Philip to rule the Netherlands. The real issue between him and them was that they wished to rule it for him, and that he, having foreseen this purpose and being distrustful of their ultimate aims and associations, had carefully arranged matters so that they could not dominate the government. Instead, Philip chose to appoint his half-sister and Charles V's bastard, Margaret of Parma, as governor, continuing in the tradition of female Habsburg royal regents in the Netherlands, beginning with Margaret of Austria and Mary of Hungary, who combined to rule over the country for 50 years. Margaret, in turn, relied on the Netherlandish nobility to advise her through the Council of State, headed by Anton de Granville, later cardinal. If you recall from the previous topic on the French Wars of Religion, the conclusion of the Italian Wars wreaked havoc on France, owing to the religious conversion of the officers to Calvinism, the issue of salaries, military idleness, and wartime taxation. The situation in the Netherlands, which is part of the Spanish crown, was victorious in those wars, mirrors the problems faced by France. With the conclusion of hostilities, the States General demanded lower taxes and the withdrawal of the Spanish army from Flanders, now perceived as a potential instrument of royal repression. Philip's signature reform, that of the reorganisation of the Netherlands diocese to ensure that local bishops had ecclesiastical authority rather than German ones, was seized upon as yet another attempt at centralisation to facilitate the repression of Protestants. Orange, Egmont, and Horn successfully forced Philip to remove Granville as head of the Council of State. De Granville was seen by many as the leading proponent of Catholicism in the Netherlands, and yet Philip had conceded to William Orange's clique to ensure harmony in his realm. Orange was Stadthalder, or steward, in the provinces of Holland, Zeeland, and Utrecht, de facto governor of the north. In 1566, Lamoral, Count Egmont, visited Philip in Spain to request a larger share of the estates of Flanders and command of an army should the need arise against France. In line with Philip's policy of concord with the Netherlandish notables and in need of support in his military endeavours against the Ottomans, he accepted and offered to finance the count. During his visit, Philip spoke frankly to the count on his intentions regarding religion, justice, finance, and security. Philip would make no compromise with any imitation or perversion of Christianity. The Catholic Church was the one Church of Christ, divinely established for the salvation of men, and that Philip would rather die than betray it. Indeed, he would rather lose 100,000 lives if he had them than tolerate any compromise that sought, by indirect methods, to eliminate Christ from his kingdoms. But insofar as there were abuses resulting from human weakness and negligence, failure to teach the Christian religion, or to discipline and order the clergy and lay members, he was willing to do anything in his power to improve matters. He was willing to permit Margaret of Parma, his governor, and the Council of State to organise better forms of religious education and to listen to alternatives regarding the punishment of heretics. Nevertheless, Philip soon began to suspect that Margaret of Parma was being swayed and manipulated by some of the Confederates, as Egmont, swiftly upon returning to Flanders, together with his allies, convinced her to call a meeting of the Estates General. De Montigny submitted a petition to Philip that he had to all but abandon his repression of the Protestants to ensure that the nobility would assist him to quash all dissent. Philip, despite his commitment to Catholicism, capitulated to obtain a temporary truce, while De Montigny sent word back to his allies that the king could not be trusted if he made concessions, inflaming tensions. Philip's confidant, Alfonso de Canto, wrote to him on July 4, 1566, that seven more of the League, seeing that they could not move the people according to their interest, have had evil preachers brought from France and Geneva, whom they have scattered through all the country, and who have persuaded people to go to hear sermons, so that now one sees troops of people leaving every town to hear preaching in French and Flemish. They preach liberty and urge people to take up arms. The Catholic nobles devoted to the king were helpless, having no orders to arm and no money with which to do so. Canto suggested that if Philip could not go himself to quell the uprising in the Netherlands, he send the Duke of Alba, former viceroy of Naples, and one of Philip's best generals to represent him. In Antwerp, 15,000 a day listened to Protestant sermons. In Brussels, dissenters walked the streets at night, singing the Psalms of David and crying, "Vivant les gueux, long live the beggars." In Brabant, dissenters were scattering billets in the streets against Margaret of Parma, such as, "Awake, Brabanton! You allow a bastard wife of a traitor and son of an infamous bugger to govern you. She has betrayed the king and the country. Chase her out and give her to the devil." Fray Lorenzo Villavicencio, a preacher of Philip's chapel, whom he had sent to Flanders as an observer, wrote to him that the authors of the League, seeing that the affairs did not go according to their pretension and desire, resolved to take another course to incite the people against your majesty, which was this. They chose 30 persons of the League, whom they sent to some to Antwerp, some to Milan, others to Ghent, and the most frequented places, that they and their friends and domestics should sit down and dine and sup at public tables and speak of the Inquisition of Spain, which your majesty wished to impose upon them. They said that your majesty intended to confiscate their goods and burn people. They invented all manner of cruelties of the inquisitors of Spain and a thousand other treasons and vagaries of their own imagining to raise the people against your majesty. This work was not in vain, claimed Fray Lorenzo to Philip, but was part of a deliberate agitation from de Coligny, the then leader of the Huguenot faction in France. Thus commenced the Beanstorm, or Statue Storm, the great iconoclasm. Here I am reading a description by Walsh from his biography of Philip II. On August 15th, when the Catholics of Antwerp were at the Vespers, singing the Salve Regina in honour of the Assumption of Our Lady, a band of Calvinists entered the church, singing some Genevan psalms, evidently the signal for an attack. The intruders proceeded to wreck one of the costliest and most beautiful churches in Europe, commencing with the famous statue of the Blessed Virgin, which had been carried in solemn procession the previous Sunday. They quickly and methodically went to the other churches, convents and monasteries, sacking one after another, while the priests and nuns fled for their lives in terror, until, by 3 o'clock in the morning, they had filled some 25 or 30 churches with wreckage. Nothing beautiful or sacred was spared. With incredible thoroughness, the vandals had ruined the ecclesiastical and artistic treasures of a great city in the brief space of 9 hours. Partisan writers have managed to dismiss this outrage as the regrettable but necessary price of progress, the growing pains of Protestantism, the revolt of a liberty-loving population against an old tyranny. Philip believed that behind all the church wreckers and Calvinist preachers was a small, secret group of conspirators hungry for power. There was no doubt in Madrid that William of Orange stood close to the centre of the whole intrigue. The fact that he left Antwerp on the morning of August 15th, only a few hours before the sacking of the churches, was considered highly suspicious. From Margaret and other informants in the north too came confirmation of the theory that Philip had to deal not only with a local uprising, which could have easily been appeased by granting of local rights or privileges, but with a phase of deep international conspiracy aided by German Lutherans, French Huguenots, especially de Coligny, and Swiss Calvinists, with domestic funding from the merchants of Antwerp, with the aim to wreck the power, prestige and religious unity of the greatest of the Catholic principalities. The Netherlands, at the geographical intersection of all of these enemies of Spain, which would later include England, was a prime target. Moreover, the Birnensturm was just one in a series of iconoclastic furies from the revolution in Copenhagen, Munster in Germany, Geneva, and most pertinent to the Netherlands, France. Philip wrote on William the Silent, "It is being said that I seek to have the head of the Prince of Orange cut off by means of the Inquisition. Never has such a thought entered my head, and even less of threatening them, as they claim with the coming of your majesty. I have no resentment of what they have done against me, imputing it to the wicked and evil men who wish to advance themselves by embroiling us with their false inventions. I add that even though they wish to be harmful to me, I have no wish to injure them, but would rather do their pleasure and service, even against their will, whenever I can without hurt the interests of your majesty, and your majesty knows the troubles I took on leaving the Low Countries to see that Pope Pius IV shall not give the Principality of Orange to the Constable of France." A reminder that William's original enclave of Orange near Avignon, the treachery of William, ran as far as to petition the Ottomans for support. The authority of Margaret had collapsed, and she appealed to Philip to intervene. Debate raged over whether the king should go to Flanders, with Ray Gomez arguing that the king should attempt to reconcile the rebels. Alba, an officer of his father Charles V and a capable commander, argued that Philip was too important to risk and that a military solution was required. Philip duly sent the Duke of Alba to Brussels with 10,000 men, wherein Alba convened the Council of Troubles to find and execute traitors. The 8-year period of conciliation was over. Alba exploited Margaret of Parma's relationship with two of the League members, Egmont and Hoorn, to entrap them and execute them for high treason. The execution of Egmont in particular was controversial, as many contended that he was more loyal to Philip than the Confederates, despite what Philip considered to be his significant role in the Birnensturm, the man who first set the plot in motion. Her power effectively usurped, Margaret of Parma resigned, leaving Alba as the governor of the Netherlands. William the Silent's territory was declared forfeit on account of his suspected treason, while he fled to the territories of the Elector of Saxony, one of the most powerful Protestant princes. William responded by organising an international intervention to depose Alba, on the flimsy pretext of rescuing his sovereign from the wicked influence of Alba, immortalised in the Dutch Wilhelmus, "I have always honoured the King of Spain." It should be noted that the surprise of Moore, the abduction of Charles IX of France, by the Huguenots the previous year, employed the same justification. Here the French wars of religion have spilled over to help ignite the 8 Years' War. The war is traditionally thought to have begun with the Battle of Heiligerlee, pitting William's relative and backer, Louis of Nassau, against a royal army, a hollow victory in the event as William's campaign was quickly bankrupted. Alba's military government successfully retook control of the country, yet drew the ire of both Catholics and Protestants when he attempted to levy the 10th penny tax on Netherlandish property to fund the army, even going as far as to implement the tax while bypassing the Estates General. With the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre, the Huguenot leader colony's execution, and the temporary rapprochement with Elizabeth of England, it appeared that Philip II was supreme. And yet a group of Calvinist pirates, unexpectedly, known as the Gueux de Mer, sea beggars, having recently been expelled by Elizabeth, unexpectedly took the undefended port of Brielle, giving the rebels a foothold. William of Orange was quickly recognised from his new base in Delft as Stadtholder of Holland, as part of an alliance between the House of Orange and the States of the North, though Amsterdam remained loyal to Philip II, as did many Catholics in Holland. Although many Catholics, who were the majority, were content with the monarchy so long as it respected the regional rights of the states, whilst also wishing for the withdrawal of Spanish armies from the Netherlands, and of course the end of the corresponding war taxes, William of Orange leaned towards the fringe of Calvinist independence fighters, himself abandoning all pretext of Catholicism in 1573, with his formal adoption of Calvinism. With this dramatic reversal, Alba was dismissed, and the Spanish crown entered bankruptcy, unable to pay its mercenary armies. Like the sack of Rome 50 years prior under Charles V, the fury of Antwerp was caused by an unpaid Spanish mercenary army consisting mainly of German Protestants. A band of mutineers had attacked the city in 1574, but Requesens, Alba's successor, had punished the ringleaders. With the king's bankruptcy in 1575, the number of troops who defied their officers and begun to live on the country increased, until in 1576 there were whole armies of irresponsible mercenaries roaming through the country. On October 20th, a band of mutineers sacked Maastricht and moved toward Antwerp, where there was a large garrison of German troops under von Ende and Oberstein. These Germans also were threatening mutiny over arrears and pay. Sancho Davila, Philip's military governor of the city and one of the boldest and most skillful of the Spanish officers, fearing that they would join the Flemish rebels in an attack on all Spanish troops in the vicinity of the city, persuaded von Ende and Oberstein to sign a treaty with him. Oberstein later offered the excuse that he was half drunk, and when affixed his signature to a paper agreeing that the burghers of Antwerp were to be disarmed and their weapons stacked in the citadel, while Oberstein would hold off the city at the disposition of Sancho Davila and admit no troop but his and the king's lawful garrison. At the same time, Oberstein was in communication with the party of William of Orange, and Sancho Davila had reason to suspect that he was planning to turn the city over to them. On the other hand, Sancho was accused later by Chapigny, governor of Antwerp, of having incited the mutiny of the Germans against Oberstein. There were accusations and counter-accusations. Antwerp was then the richest city in Europe, where merchants and bankers lived in palaces with regal pomp and luxury. Along the river were massive warehouses stuffed with treasures. The mutineers succeeded in butchering thousands and driving 7,000 others to death in flames of water. 80 houses were burned. The massacre was indiscriminate, falling equally on all races, laying low the women with the men, and Catholic priests with Protestants and Jews. The houses on 13 streets were destroyed by fire. Some considered this divine retribution on the population of Antwerp for the Bedenstorm 10 years before. For Philip II, it was a disaster in fueling anti-Spanish and anti-Catholic propaganda. William Cecil, chief minister to Elizabeth, penned the pamphlets A Warning Song to All Cities to Aware by Antwerp's Fall, and Heavy News to All Christendom from the Woeful Town of Antwerp Come. For the next two generations, Antwerp took the place of Jerusalem, Sodom, Gomorrah, and Babylon, as a warning example for wicked Londoners, if any such they were. William of Orange brilliantly seized upon this indiscriminate slaughter of Philip's subjects, regardless of religious affiliation, to affirm the pacification of Ghent. In this treaty, the Catholic provinces of Brabant, Hainaut, Flanders, Artois, Nemours, northern France and Belgium agreed to support the Protestant states of Holland and Zeeland in military resistance until the Spanish troops should be withdrawn. The Estates General was convoked and various oppressive measures repealed. Only Luxembourg and Limburg, modern-day southeastern Netherlands, remained loyal to Philip. The Spanish military effort collapsed. Don Juan of Austria, victor of Lepanto, and the new governor of the Netherlands found himself almost helpless. The masterstroke of Orange was to ostensibly recognise the king's sovereignty, promising to acknowledge the royal authority in all the estates, to maintain the Catholic religion, to disband the foreign Protestant soldiers, and to accept Don Juan as governor. All this on condition that the Spanish troops depart forever, that all prisons be released, that a general amnesty be granted, that the Estates General meet on the same basis as in the time of his father, Charles V, and that Don Juan accept the principles of the pacification of Ghent. This was essentially an offer to go back to the status quo of 1558, the year of Charles V's death, albeit 3 years after his abdication, and to forsake all the various demands by which William had at first aroused and then maintained the agitation against Philip. While this proposal was being considered by Don Juan, Orange was already making military preparations and advising the estates to seize him. To Orange's great surprise, Don Juan, at the command of the king himself and against his own judgment, promptly accepted all the conditions. Don Juan, in the king's name, signed in February 1577 an agreement called the Perpetual Edict, actually a restatement and ratification of the pacification of Ghent. He swore to dismiss the foreign troops within 40 days, to pay for any damages done by the mutineers and others, and to maintain all the ancient privileges and customs of the country. The 17 provinces agreed to disband their troops, to contribute 600,000 livres toward the expense of removing the Spanish troops, and to pay the arrears of the Germans. To acknowledge, moreover, Don Juan as governor, and to maintain the Catholic religion. From the amnesty now granted, Philip did not accept even the Prince of Orange, though he still considered him, as he wrote to Don Juan, the inventor, author, and contriver of all the evils that afflict my country. Philip had always contended that the essential principle for which he was struggling, was the maintenance of the Catholic religion. This was now conceded. The bluff of William of Orange was called. The Catholic population, which had thrown itself into his arms after the mutinies of 1576, was drawn back to the royal cause, and the king had recovered a good moral standing. King Philip, encouraged by this success and by the restoration of his credit, thanks to bullion supplies from the New World, was resolved to have the last word with William of Orange. The Jesuits, the famous Catholic Society of Jesus, founded some 40 years earlier by Ignatius of Loyola to lead conversions across the world, suffered especially under William of Orange, who entertained a particular hatred for them due to their unrelenting devotion to the Catholic Church and the Pope. The Jesuits were required to take an oath to affirm the pro-Protestant clauses in the pacification of Ghent, which they duly refused. Jesuits in Antwerp were punished by the closing of their church. Of a community of Franciscans, only 10 took the oath when commanded to do so by 150 Protestant soldiers. The rest, with their guardian, chose exile. On the feast of Corpus Christi, the body of Christ, in 1578, when all Catholics all over the Low Countries were showing their usual devotion, Calvinists seized the churches in Brussels, Liège, and Amsterdam. They fell upon the worshippers, killed or wounded many, and after smashing images and crucifixes in various churches, drove the Franciscans and other religious out of the cities. The Catholics were taken by surprise. Only in Mechelen did they take up arms to protect the churches from the sack. Ghent, in the heart of Flanders, the birthplace of Charles V, was transformed into a Calvinist republic on the model of Geneva. In response, Philip funded the expedition of Alexander Farnese, Duke of Parma, to the Netherlands. Upon his arrival, Artois, Hainaut, and Douai, which only 3 years prior had allied with Orange against Don Juan and Philip, enthusiastically entered into the Union of Arras, confirming the prohibition of Calvinism. In response, the northern states, Holland, Zeeland, Utrecht, Groningen, entered into the Union of Utrecht with Antwerp as its capital, permitting unlimited religious toleration, although this wasn't at first explicit for Catholics. This effectively marks the beginning of the statehood for the nation we know today as the Netherlands. Having informally forsworn Philip of Spain and declared independence, the Dutch looked for protection from Elizabeth, who prevaricated, hoping not to directly provoke Philip without due cause. Moreover, Elizabeth was fixated on the cost of such an undertaking. Instead, the leader of the anti-absolutist and Huguenot-sympathetic malcontent faction in France, Francis of Anjou, brother of Henry III, was invited by the Rump States General to become king. In so doing, the Estates General formally issued the Act of Abjuration in 1581, releasing public officials of their oath of allegiance to Philip, effectively deposing him and terminating the indivisibility of the Netherlands as proclaimed in the Pragmatic Sanction of 1549. The supporters of the Act, aware of the gravity of betraying the authority of a legitimate and anointed sovereign, argued that this was not a deposition, but rather Philip had deserted his realm, leaving the states with no choice. The preamble to the Act was an indictment against the tyranny of Philip, taking much inspiration from the Monachomach pamphleteers in France, in particular De Vindice contra Tyrannos, Defences of Liberty Against Tyrants, published 2 years before by de Monet, under the pseudonym Junius Brutus, Lucius Junius Brutus, of course, the founder of the Roman Republic, who deposed Tarquinius Superbus after the rape and suicide of Lucretia. Debate rages over whether the Act should be interpreted as a uniquely Calvinist doctrine or an allusion to the medieval privileges found in preceding documents such as the Great Privilege, the Dutch equivalent of the Magna Carta, of Mary of Burgundy. Whether this constitutes a restoration or a revolution, the latter interpretation presages the Dutch conquest of England, Scotland and Ireland in 1688, the so-called Glorious Revolution, whose origin is fittingly and unsurprisingly Dutch, and the indictment against the crimes of George III in the American Declaration of Independence some 100 years later. The restoration argument bears closer inspection when contending with the Republican president of the Frisian Freedom, and yet Frisia was the exception to the rule, nor did all Frisia accept the Act of Abjuration at first. In fact, many officials resigned rather than acknowledging the Act. The disunity that followed is exemplified by the farce that was Anjou's campaign for the throne. Anjou failed to establish his rule, rejected by Catholics for his Huguenot sympathies and Calvinists for not abjuring his Catholicism. Anjou resorted to a forlorn attempt at a coup in Antwerp, the so-called French Fury, and died the subsequent year. Without a king, the act of abjuration had not only deposed a legitimate monarch, but failed to install a new one, ushering in a republic in Holland and Zeeland, and later the Seven Provinces, by accident. William of Orange, not as king or even as count, but as stadtholder, steward of Holland and Zeeland, now ruled in fact, ending 700 years of continuous noble rule, and after his assassination in 1584 by Balthasar Gyard, his successors of the House of Orange would inherit the title of stadtholder and occupy the position of an ersatz prince over the Seven Provinces, and later become kings of the Netherlands. From his base in the south, Alba defeated the Confederates in Brabant and Flanders, taking Antwerp, precipitating a mass exodus of the city, which lost over half of its population of 100,000. The lines were now drawn for two Netherlands, the south in union with Spain, Catholic, rebuilding from the iconoclastic fury that had taken Ghent, Brussels and Antwerp. The north, an incidental republic, Calvinist, with large Catholic pockets converting over the next half century. Robert Dudley, Elizabeth's favourite, was sent to rescue the situation in the Netherlands, as her ally France had fallen under the influence of the Spanish-allied Henry, Duke of Guise. Unsuccessful, the duty of defending the Dutch fell to Maurice of Orange, son of William the Silent. The turning point against Spain came in 1588 and 9. Henry of Guise was assassinated, and Mary, Queen of Scots, was executed, ensuring that the Calvinist Henry III of Navarre and James VI of Scotland would become the rulers of France and England, respectively. England would remain, and France would become, a Protestant power and enemies of Spain. The Netherlands had now become a peripheral concern despite the success of the Duke of Parma. The attempt to conquer England in 1588 with the Spanish Armada failed, and in 1589 Henry of Navarre became King of France by right of Salic law. Parma was sent to France, where after the death of the Catholic candidate for the throne, Philip tried to place his own daughter Isabella on the French throne to no avail. France was lost, though Henry, now Henry IV, converted to Catholicism, he declared war on Spain with English support. Maurice of Orange expanded the new Netherlands, taking the old seat of his father at Breda, taking Nijmegen and Groningen. Several attempts to attack or liberate the south were opposed by Maurice of Orange and were unsuccessful. By now, the prosperous Dutch had returned to a focus on trade. Amsterdam benefited from the decline of Antwerp. The new boundary between the states effectively placed Antwerp under a permanent blockade. Thereafter, the great trading ports in the south became Dunkirk and later Ostend. From Amsterdam, the Dutch became master shipbuilders, attacking the possessions of another of Philip II's kingdoms, Portugal. A temporary peace was achieved with the 12 years' truce of 1609, affording the Dutch the time to consolidate their naval power. While the Spanish would not accept the loss of the Netherlands until the Peace of Munster in 1648, by 1609, Dutch independence was an inarguable fact. Particularism had been at the heart of this conflict. So had been the preservation of an idea of the Netherlands free from foreign occupation. The south had become more consolidated under Spanish rule, and the presence of Spanish armies would remain a fact for the next century, and then only to be replaced by Austrian armies. In the north, the rights of the Seven Provinces, as he seceded, were nominally upheld, and yet the conflict had not been in defence of personal liberty or the values of republicanism. Republicanism was incidental, both to the creation and maintenance of the United Provinces. What emerged as the first Dutch nation-state was a republic dominated by a prince, the Prince of Orange, a confederation dominated by a single member, Holland. If we return to the origins of William of Orange's ambitions and those of his family, he ultimately succeeded in his desire to rule over a domain independent either in fact or in law from Spain, forever irreconcilable to direct Spanish rule on account of a Calvinist revolution now firmly established that Orange himself had helped facilitate.